Next case is Pfizer versus Sanofi Pasteur, 2024-2199-2201-02. Mr. Scheibel, when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm John Scheibel for Pfizer in the case. Thank you for taking the time to hear our case. The board decision below finding that substitute claims 48 and 49 were obvious is not supported by the substantial evidence and must be reversed. The board used a baseline selection routine optimization theory.
Counsel, these are composition claims, and they consist of claim 46, which has already been held invalid, plus other known serotypes. And it seems plainly obvious to add other known serotypes to improve coverage. And the distinction that you're arguing is a property as determined by a particular test system. But nonetheless, at bottom, these claims consist of the composition claims consisting of known serotypes plus known serotypes. That would seem to be fairly obvious.
Your Honor, thank you. So claim 46 recited 14 serotypes, and this court, in its prior decision, found that claim 46, affirmed the board's finding that claim 46 was obvious, based on some expressed teachings in the prior art, showing that those serotypes were conjugated and exhibited immunogenicity in the 2-log range required by the claim. So specifically, this court affirmed the board's finding that the Merck 086 reference found 13 serotypes achieved 2-log.
We sent this case back because the board didn't deal with 48 and 49. Now they've done so, and so why shouldn't we affirm based on substantial evidence?
They've done so with a decision that is substantially tracks almost verbatim the decision the board made in the prior case with respect to claim 46, and the board did not address the arguments that petitioner made distinguishing claims 48 and 49 from the findings with respect to claim 46.
Distinguishing them based on a test system.
So the claim 40, for example, claim 48 requires two additional serotypes, 15B and 33F. And it requires that the composition exhibit a two log increase with respect to those two serotypes. Serotype 15B, Your Honor, was never conjugated in the prior art. There's no immunogenicity data in the prior art with respect to serotype 15B. Serotype 33F was conjugated in the prior art by the Merck 086 reference. However, that Merck 086 reference showed the data in Table 4 of that reference shows that serotype 33F, when conjugated in a 15-valent vaccine, did not meet 2-log. These are distinct differences between claim 48 and claim 46.
But what the board was only considering, because I don't think you've raised a motivation to combine issue here. So the only thing before the board, whether there was a reasonable expectation of success, as you know from our case law, there's no certitude required, there's no absolute likeliness. It's simply a reasonable expectation of success. So given the studies, Merck 086, Hausoff, and what we said in Pfizer with respect to claim 46 and also claims 1 and 3, how under substantial evidence review, considering expert testimony, was the board not within its bounds to conclude that there was a reasonable expectation of success? I'm not saying it.
Because, Your Honor, in claim 46, the board decision was affirmed based on express disclosures in the prior art. And that just doesn't exist here. You have, for example, what I mentioned for 15B and 33F in claim 48. Claim 49 gets even more egregious in that Claim 49 requires serotypes 12F, 11A, 10A, and 8. These are four serotypes also that were never conjugated in the prior art. There's no immunogenicity.
In the case when we're analyzing whether you would have had a reasonable expectation of success to do it, doesn't that assume that it hadn't been done and you need some testing or some routine optimization? And the question is whether you would have done that assuming that there was some reasonable expectation of success. So the fact it wasn't there, that's an obvious combination kind of motivation thing. That's not reasonable expectation of success, is it?
We believe there was no reasonable expectation of success because there was no showing in the art of that those serotypes were conjugated. And more importantly, there is no showing in the art that serotypes 15B, 12F, 11A, 10A, and 8 had any immunogenicity data. Of course there was no showing of immunogenicity data with respect to those serotypes. They were never conjugated.
Those serotypes are in the claim. And so you're essentially arguing that there's no expectation that they would be effective. And you want to premise an argument for patentability on the ineffectiveness of components?
What the prior decision held, what we're saying is we're not saying it's not effective. We're saying the claim requires a specific rise over baseline to log. And with respect to that element, there's no reasonable expectation of success in the art that one could increase a multivalent conjugate from Merck's 15 or Hausdorff's 13 up to the 16 valent in claim 48 or up to the 20 valent in claim 49 and achieve that two log increase with a reasonable expectation of success.
So you're disputing the evidence that the board considered. I mean, the board is allowed to listen to the expert testimony and reject it or accept it based on credibility or substance. And that's what the board did, right?
The board relied on, in the new decision, testimony from Sanofi's expert that an artisan would optimize the baseline. That is to say that the artisan would choose particular rabbits that have a certain low baseline so that you could meet the two log requirement. Their own expert, Dr. Van Alphen, testified that he wouldn't do that. He wouldn't exclude rabbits from testing he did. He also testified that he wouldn't select germ-free rabbits. There's no teaching in the art that you would choose baseline to optimize an outcome. It's just simply not shown. The prior art below shows that the baseline is, the board held that baseline is a results effective variable. And that's simply an incorrect conclusion. The prior art below never recognized baseline as a result-effective variable. None of the prior art references indicate that two-log increase would be something desirable. The board cited Hausdorff and looked at this Table 3 and Table 5 of the Hausdorff reference, and specifically with respect to serotype 1. And from that comparison of those two different example tables, which are unrelated experiments, the board concluded that one skilled in the art would look at those two different experiments, compare the tables, and see for serotype 1 that if you decreased baseline, you could get an increase in fold rise. Now, Pfizer's position is that doesn't mean the artisan would not look at Hausdorff's two different tables from two different experiments and compare data that way because they're different experiments with different purposes. But if you're going to look at the data in that table, look at all the data. And if you look at all the data, and we put this in page 17 of our reply brief, we have a table with some green and orange coloring. And that table shows for serotypes 3, 6A, 18C, 19A, and 23F, which are highlighted in orange in that table, that a decrease in baseline resulted in a decrease in fold rise. That's exactly the opposite of what Sanofi's expert and the board relied on in connection with serotype 1 in that table. Also, in that table, for serotypes 4 and 5, where the baseline is the same from both tables 3 to 4, these are the rows highlighted in green, you see that the fold rise, where the baseline is the same, you see fold rise going in two different directions. The point is that with this table, if you're going to look at all the data, if you're not just selectively at the serotype 1 data, what it shows is that it's unpredictable. Changing baseline is unpredictable in its effect on fold rise. And if it's unpredictable in its effect on fold rise, it cannot be a results-optimizable variable. Yet the board found it was a result-optimizable variable, and we believe that's error.
On that point, though, they relied on Dr. Alfin's testimony. So they accepted testimony of the expert on that point, right, on routine optimization being able to...
They accepted his testimony in the face of deposition testimony that he gave saying he would never select baseline, he would never select germ-free rabbits in doing these analyses. They selected that, they credited his testimony in the face of this explicit table 3 and table 5, two disparate experiments that shouldn't be compared, but to the extent they are compared, the data show that it goes every which way, nothing predictable.
Counsel, you still haven't gotten around the points that your claim recites the combination of all serotypes plus all serotypes, which would seem to be obvious.
This art is unpredictable. We say the conjugation techniques and the creation of these multivalent conjugates is empirical in nature. It's unpredictable. We have sites for that in the record. When you cannot just increase valency up to infinity with a reasonable expectation of, forget infinity, excuse me. You cannot increase valency up to 16 or 20 with any expectation of reasonable expectation of success. There are interdependent immune responses of each serotype when delivered to a subject, a rabbit or a human.
Into your rebuttal time.
Yes, I'd like to reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Zygmunt Guttman. I represent Appalese Sanofi Vaccine Corporation and SK Biosciences. I think what we heard from my friend on the other side is a focus on the board's decision that there was a reasonable expectation of success based on routine optimization of the baseline. And I want to put that aside for a minute because I think the overarching issue here that was addressed during the questioning of Pfizer is whether there is a reasonable expectation of success and whether that reasonable expectation of success as concluded by the board was supported by substantial evidence, and the answer is yes.
Implicit in what you're saying, I just want to make sure I got it right before you move on. You don't need the baseline optimization rationale of the board in order for us to affirm? Is that what you're telling us?
That's correct, Your Honor, that the overarching question here is, was there a reasonable expectation of success at arriving at the claimed composition? And I think the board concluded that there was, and I'll identify some examples of what that substantial evidence is. But I think Judge Lori and Judge Prost identified some of that evidence. There was expert testimony by Dr. Van Alphen, which was Sanofi's expert. There was even expert testimony from Pfizer's own expert, Dr. Paradiso. There were declarations submitted by Dr. Van Alphen. The Hausdorff reference itself on its face supports the board's conclusion that there was a reasonable expectation of success, as does the Merck 086 reference. And this court, in its prior decision in addressing Claim 46, and this is actually a quote that was addressed in the board's final written decision, said that Merck 086 and Hausdorff clearly demonstrated that the claim 2 log IgG increase could be achieved across various serotypes in a multivalent composition. And that's consistent with the board's findings that Hausdorff and Merck, without resort to a routine optimization theory, established that there was a reasonable expectation of success. And for good reason, Hausdorff on its face in Table 3 demonstrated that for various serotypes, as referenced by this court in its prior decision, for each of those serotypes had achieved a 2-log increase. And
but how aren't the serotypes in 46, in Claim 46, different than those in 48 and 49? And that's, I think, your friend's point.
Yes, there are additional serotypes that are recited in Claims 48 and 49. That doesn't change the fact that Hausdorff and Merck and the other substantial evidence I made reference to established that a person of ordinary skill in the art would reasonably expect to succeed at taking serotypes that were known to be immunogenic. And so, to Judge Lori's point, these are composition claims. The serotypes recited in Claims 48 and 49 had already been...
Those were known. They were reported in GSK, correct?
That's correct. And not only were they reported as being immunogenic in GSK 711, Your Honor, but they were included in commercially available vaccines already. Some of them were. And so the prior art disclosed the immunogenic property of each and every one of those serotypes that are recited in Claims 48 and 49. And so the question, which this court addressed in its prior decision in connection with Claim 46, was whether the prior art established a reasonable expectation of success without resort to any theory regarding routine optimization. That is just additional evidence for why there exists a reasonable expectation of success that a POSA could achieve the 2-log increase for...
Person of skill in the art, speaking English.
Yes, I apologize, Your Honor. Yes, that a person of skill in the art...
But your opponent is saying the 2-log increase was not shown. So he's premising his argument on the purported ineffectiveness of a compound of the claim.
Well, so first of all, there's no record evidence that any of the serotypes that weren't expressly disclosed in Hausdorff or Merck that are recited in Claims 48 and 49, there's no record evidence that those serotypes are any different than the serotypes that were addressed in connection with Hausdorff and Merck, for which there was shown a 2-log increase. And this raises an important issue, because to summarize what my friend's argument is, it's that in order to establish a reasonable expectation of success for a claimed combination, a claimed composition combination, it's incumbent on the challenger, and this is contrary to law, that there needs to be an express disclosure of each and every claim limitation in the prior art. And based on that legally contradictory position. Pfizer is taking the position that Merck doesn't have any data, and the combination of Merck and Hausdorff don't have any data to establish a two-log increase for the serotypes recited in claims 48 and 49 that are not expressly addressed in those references. And that's not the law. As this court has repeatedly stated and stated in its prior decision, all that's necessary is a reasonable expectation of success. And in fact, there's...
You said a few minutes ago that you suggested, I don't think you really meant this, that it was kind of his burden, that there are other things out there, and he hasn't shown that they would react differently. Is that the way the system's supposed to work? It's...
No, Your Honor. I'm not, I apologize. I don't mean to suggest that it's Pfizer's burden to establish the existence of a reasonable expectation of success. The standard of review today is whether the board's decision is supported by substantial evidence. And I think there is. What I'm doing is addressing, their legally incorrect argument that there must be an express disclosure in the prior art of each and every claim limitation. And on that, there, all that is required is a reasonable expectation of success. And there is substantial evidence in the record to support the board's conclusion that there was, in fact, a reasonable expectation of success. And this court has addressed that issue head on in multiple cases, including the CFRD Research Incorporated case, 876 F3rd 1330, where this court said a claimed invention may be obvious even when the prior art does not teach each claim limitation. And Bexon Marine Inc. versus NFM 292 F3rd 718, obviousness does not require the prior art to reach expressly each limitation exactly. That's the whole point of the obviousness analysis.
This isn't a structural limitation of this composition claim. It's a result, correct? It's an indication of a property under certain conditions. It's not a structural. It's not a description of a component that we're talking about.
I think that's correct, Your Honor, that the two-log increase is a property of the serotypes that comprise the composition, which is being claimed in claims 48 and 49. To shift gears a little bit into routine optimization, even though as I stated before, I don't think it's necessary that the court needs to consider the routine optimization argument or theory in order to affirm the board's decision, because the board broadly found that there was a reasonable expectation of success. But I'd like to do that given that it was the focus of Pfizer's appeal, and it relates to Your Honor's question regarding the property of a two-log increase. And so there's an abundance of substantial evidence. Again, the face of Hausdorff and Merck, which was referenced by the board in connection with its analysis of routine optimization, as well as Hausdorff and Merck and expert testimony that established that at least baseline and both adjuvant and dose amounts are results effective variables that can drive the result of establishing the level of immunogenicity, including the result of a two-log increase. And I believe this was discussed with my friend on the other side, that there was a motivation, and there is no dispute on this point, that there was a motivation by persons of ordinary skill in the art to increase the immunogenicity of immunogenic compositions such as those claimed in claims 48 and 49. So when you combine the motivation to increase immunogenicity and achieve a two-log increase, which was actually done on the face of Hausdorff and Merck with various serotypes, as this court referenced in its prior decision, and you're using results-effective variables like modifying the baseline, which, you know, the claim on its face talks about a 2-log increase over baseline. It's not rocket science. You don't need, you know, an advanced degree to know that if you want to achieve a 2-log increase over baseline, if you lower the baseline, you're going to increase the difference between the level of immunogenicity and the baseline. If you increase the baseline, you're going to narrow the level of immunogenicity and make it smaller. And so there was a clear recognition as established by expert testimony, including Pfizer's own expert.
What about the evidence from your expert that he would never do that, and the sort of suggestion that that's kind of cheating, I suppose, to modify the baseline?
So I want to thank you for asking that or addressing that, Your Honor, because I think when you look at the deposition testimony, I don't agree with my friend's characterization of Dr. Van Alphen's deposition testimony. First of all, there's nothing on the face of the claim that requires regulatory approval for these compositions. Second of all, what Dr. Van Alphen in context was talking about during his deposition testimony was excluding data. He specifically referenced excluding data.
Okay to exclude certain rabbits, just don't exclude the result of the rabbits you test?
Exactly, Your Honor. And in fact, that's done all the time, even in the context of human clinical trials, where there are exclusion criteria for patients who enroll in the trials. Part of the trial design is you figure out, you know, and this is beyond, you know, my ability to really explain in simple terms or in any terms, really. But, you know, the part of the trial design is figuring out who can participate in the trial and who cannot participate in the trial in order to drive the appropriate analysis. And what Dr. Van Alphen was saying is, essentially, we're going to have exclusion criteria for rabbits. And one of the exclusion...
What's your response, if any, to the table in the gray brief at page 17 that counsel talked about? Go ahead.
Yeah. So, frankly, I think that it doesn't alter the conclusion that there exists substantial evidence in the record to support the board's decision. I think what... you know, I was hearing from my friend was really a re-argument of the merits of the case and asking this court to reweigh the evidence in view of arguments that were presented, really for the first time in this briefing. I think when you look at pages 16 and 17 where this argument is made, you'll look in vain for any citation to any record evidence or any argument that was before the board that encapsulates this argument. So this is, you know, really a retrospective argument addressing the issue of whether the board's consideration of Hausdorff should stand or not. And, of course, that's not the standard. The standard is substantial evidence. And I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Schreiber has some rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the question of old serotypes, the serotypes 15B, 15B, 12F, 10A, 11A, 8. Yes, GSK711 shows a long list of serotypes, polysaccharides that were in the prior art and known to be immunogenic. GSK says any of the serotypes that are described can be conjugated to CRIM. But what GSK doesn't show you is data of what immune response you get. So you have then an unknown immune response to these conjugates that were not exemplified in GSK, only prophetically discussed. And from there, you can say, you can optimize that prophetic conjugate with an unknown rune response up to 2 log? That is erroneous. That's a jump in logic. That is what the problem is with the board's decision. And what the board did, Judge Prost mentioned shifting burden. The board at Appendix 96 said Pfizer hasn't come forward with evidence to show that the serotypes in these additional claims act in any different way. That's a burden shift. That's an improper burden shift requiring the patent owner to show patentability. Improper. In any event, we did show that serotypes behave differently. Serotype 33F is one. Serotypes 1 and 3 are another. Merck 086 reference, it optimized dose, it optimized adjuvant. It said in tables 3 and 4 that we're going to test the lead formulations that they've created. And in those lead formulations, they failed to achieve the 2-log increase for serotypes 33F, serotypes 1, and serotypes 3. Those are three examples of serotypes that we showed behave differently. We met the burden that the board shifted to us. There's a commentary about we don't need the routine optimization part of the board's decision to affirm. Sure you do. When you look at the decision below, it starts off with motivation, and it discusses what the references teach it with respect to motivation to include these additional serotypes into a vaccine. We don't dispute that. But when you get to the question of reasonable expectation of success, the board ends at the Sanofi's experts' baseline selection theory. And that baseline selection theory, it's not appropriate given the evidence of the record and Sanofi's expert, just I'll end with this, he said, I'm not allowed to exclude animals because you don't like it. The experimental design is always discussed with the animal authorities in the institute before they give permission, and there's no way of excluding data. That's life. That's Appendix 21-281.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Time is up. We thank both counsel. The case is submitted.